And whether they're going to concede, finally, that these people were soldiers, or whether they're going to insist that because there were cases where they were at camps, where Osama bin Laden came and gave them a talk every now and then, that makes them al-Qaeda. It's always been a lie that the majority of the prisoners were involved in terrorism in any way, I believe. And, you know, I'm hoping that what this is going to do, and I'm hoping that the hysteria at present is going to die down, is that we are going to address that issue and we're going to say, hey, we've been holding soldiers for all this time and we didn't give them the rights that we should. The conflict's coming to an end. They've got to go home.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to pick up this conversation next week. Andy Worthington, British journalist who recently wrote the piece Missing the Point on the Guantanamo-Taliban Prisoner Swap and the release of Bo Bergdahl. His book is called Guantanamo Files, and we'll link to the article at democracynow.org. And thanks so much, Frank Goldsmith, for joining us representing one of the prisoners, Khairullah Harqua, who is now in Qatar. That does it for the broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berger, Nate Felser, Armato Nimi, Shakespeare, Martinez, Sam Malcolm, Fani, Masu, Gravy, Karen, Dina, Gester, Amy, Littlefield, I mean, Google, Warren Gonzalez, thanks for joining us.
The time is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. The keynote speaker will be Sherry Hunkala, a national activist in anti-poverty movements and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series. June 7th at 7 p.m. will show Meet the Falkins. Louise and Martine Falkins are identical twins. For over 50 years, they were working as prostitutes. They freed themselves from the control of their pimps, ran their own brothel, and set up the first informal trade union for prostitutes. Meet the Falkins is a portrait of these women. Again, that's June 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a shooting at Seattle Pacific University yesterday left one dead and two wounded.
Houseless activists crashed the Rose Festival to bring attention to the issues surrounding houselessness.
And all states now have had marriage equality lawsuits active in their legal justice system.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 6, 2014. I'm Theo Burke.
And I'm Liam Delta. Thousands of people are setting up tents and chairs tonight to hold their place for tomorrow's Rose Festival Grand Floral Parade. But one group of campers are not just trying to hold a spot. They're trying to raise awareness about what they see as the criminalization of homelessness in Portland and across the nation. These campers are with Right to Dream 2, a rest area for houseless people established in downtown Portland in late 2011. They're being joined by people from as far away as Seattle and San Francisco and supported by Jobs with Justice, Sisters of the Road Cafe, Seattle Share Wheel, and other groups. Every year at this time, the city of Portland permits the public to pitch tents along the Grand Floral Parade route and other parade venues. But every other day of the year, camping in the city is outlawed, causing houseless people to seek shelter in doorways, under bridges, and in bushes, or trying to sleep without shelter. Their sleep is often interrupted by police and security guards who perform routine sweeps. Organizers chose Sleepless Nights, Know Your Rights, as the theme for this year's Pitch a Tent event, highlighting everyone's need for a peaceful night's rest and the need for houseless people to stand up for their human rights. Organizers want to highlight the Oregon Homeless Bill of Rights, a legislative campaign for a comprehensive law addressing the human rights of houseless people. KBOO's Theo Burke went downtown to Southwest 4th Avenue and Washington Street, the heart of the encampment where the Right to Survive supporters have set up for the night along 4th Avenue. He spoke first with an activist identified as 99, and then with Ibrahim Mubarak, a leader and houseless advocate for Right to Dream 2.
We're looking to capitalize off the fact that just this one day of year, like they do on Christmas, everybody's hearts open up. And there's all this kindness. They allow people to camp on the streets.
Yeah, right.
And so this is what this is. And then when we done just took it a little step further, you know, we done brought coffee out here. We got food out here. We're barbecuing, you know, because back in the day, you used to could do that. Now you can't do that. Now there's some stuff about open flame and blah, 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 blah. Okay.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Do you want to... leave your name. You can leave.
Yes, sir. I'm 99, people, and it's a pleasure talking to you guys.
99. Okay. Thank you, 99.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Have a good.
The city give a permit and allow people to come here and pitch up tent for leisure to watch a parade. So we having a direct action of filling all the parade routes with tents and allowing homeless people to come in there and enjoy the festivities. Also, it's a two thing. It's to educate the public. That it's not enough shelter space, not enough affordable housing, and the criminalizing of humans for having to sleep on the streets, and to protest the camping ban so maybe the city can allocate more vacant lots or spaces and to have places like Right to Dream too.
So part of your message then is this is the one day that camping is legal every year. When there's a parade, what about the other 364?
Exactly, when people need a place to sleep, when they need to feel safe and get a good night's rest so they can think about on becoming productive.
This is easier to get to, this one you have now?
It's easier to get to. It's in walking distance of all the social services.
Oh, okay.
There's no privacy when you're living on the streets, and there's no public restroom when you're living on the streets. And it's the same thing with people that live inside of houses. They urinate, they do drugs, they get drunk, they put needles everywhere. So what's the difference? The difference is the social status, the have and the have not. These people have places to go to. The people on the street don't have places to go to.
I don't know, tonight there's going to be a party, I understand. The Radical Cheerleaders, my friend Shoehorn, the tap dancing sax man and jazz man. Yeah. And
Mike Crenshaw,
hip-hop artist.
We're going to have Paul Bolden from Rap in San Francisco come give a speech. I may give a speech. You're going to have William Schreiber, who's a street musician, going to come play music. You're going to have, Marissa Marcellus, her band's going to come. Huh. You got plenty. You got the fire twirlers.
And I see jugglers already.
Yeah, the jugglers. And so you're going to have lots of entertainment here.
What time?
It starts at 6:30.
Right here at 4th and, Washington.
4th and Washington.
You apparently have people coming from all over. Is that true? San Francisco, Seattle?
Yeah.
Do you have those folks here now? Or?
Well, they roaming around or being tourists right now.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day, man.
Yeah, they're seeing the sights in Portland first.
You better believe it. I can't blame them.
Okay, well, Ibrahim Mubarak.
No problem.
Theo Burke, KBOO News, thank you very much for your help.
Thank you very much.
Portland police say they plan to step up gang patrols this weekend. The PPD reports that gang violence on the rise makes it necessary for the Bureau's gang enforcement team, the Gun Task Force, and local cop shops to be visible patrolling through the weekend. Police attribute a rash of 4 shootings last June 8th to gang activity. This planned crackdown on alleged gang activity comes on the same weekend as the Rose Festival, with hundreds of Navy midshipmen descending on downtown Portland. The weekend is often marked by drunken fights and multiple arrests for disorderly conduct. But with the plan to go after alleged gang members on the same weekend, The force deployed downtown to deal with Fleet Week incidents will likely be lighter than usual.
Yesterday, a gunman opened fire on students and faculty at Seattle Pacific University shortly before 3:30 p.m. He shot three people, killing one and seriously wounding two others. Seattle police released the name of the suspect today, identifying the 26-year-old man as Aaron Ibarra from Mount Lake Terrace, Washington. He was carrying several rounds of shotgun shells and a knife. While stopping to reload, the suspect was pepper sprayed and tackled by a student working as a building monitor. Ibarra was in court today for a bail hearing at 1:30. A motive for the shooting has not been released by police.
This week, the Portland City Council was slated to consider a proposal to institute a late-night activity permit for all businesses open after 10 p.m. The motion was postponed due to time constraints, but it opened up a debate about the targeting of Portland's hip-hop community by the city government and police. KBOO reporter Ryan Katz spoke with local artist Glenn Waco on the proposal and the treatment of city officials towards hip-hop artists in general.
I'm speaking with Glenn Waco, a local hip-hop artist here in Portland. Glenn, first, tell me a little bit about the incident at the Blue Monk in March. What exactly happened?
I think it was March 22nd, Immaculate and Mikey Vegas. They threw a show at Blue Monk. This unnecessary police force came out, and they basically just shut down the show. Immaculate got on stage and said he wasn't going to perform in Portland anymore if hip-hop culture was going to be like persecuted like that, because their whole case of being there has changed from the capacity limit to gang affiliation to one of the performers to something else. I don't know. I can't keep up with as many stories as they've come up with.
Has the persecution of hip hop in Portland been a widespread problem in the past?
This has been an ongoing thing, and the mentality has always been like, I quote this Willamette Weekly article from like 2005 or 2006, a rapper by the name of Keek the Sneak came to town from the Bay Area and he threw a show. And it was after that event, and a police sergeant got quoted as saying, like, it's no coincidence that a whole bunch of violence go on around a hip hop event. So the mentality of the city's been there, you know, that's been the mentality of the city of Portland and the police brew. So it's nothing new.
Can you describe a little bit of the fallout from what happened at Blue Monk? How did various community members react to that?
The independent police report or whatever, the IPR, they were supposed to do an investigation. Nobody knows what went on with that. I mean, a bunch of people called the IPR to, you know, make statements. So that's been the response. People called that was there and, you know, complained about the police unnecessary force. The gang tasking force came in and were just set off just like this vibe that just to intimidate concert goers that was just unnecessary. Before they showed up, it was just a friendly hip-hop event, you know? Like, there was no guns, no stereotypical stuff going on. It was just a good show, and people there came there to have fun. And the police, gang tasking force, came in there and just messed up the whole vibe for everybody.
So is the Blue Monk incident an example of a general trend in Portland?
I think it's an agenda going on with the city of Portland. They're trying to develop, and they're trying to turn downtown into something else from what it is right now, and all this hip-hop cultures and all this hipster, pseudo-liberal image that they portray Portland and being like, that's not really what Portland is, you know what I'm saying? Like, hip-hop is a part of Portland. I honestly think that they're trying to knock out these bars and develop something else. And I don't think that hip-hop culture is a part of that development plan.
You're describing a process of gentrification. What impact does this process have on the communities of color here in Portland?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. A lot of people make gentrification out to be a bad thing. And I don't necessarily think gentrification has to be a bad thing if money wasn't valued over human decency. Because what's going on is, you know, they're developing condos and they're putting up these new businesses. And that's cool because, you know, that creates jobs. You know, people are making money. But at the same time, you're displacing minorities and lower class, you know, people over to Southeast Portland. Over the past decade, they've shut down schools and taken away culture from neighborhoods and in the place of, you know, corporations. Like, this is, if you go to North Portland, there's a 7-Eleven, like, every five blocks. And that's what it is. If they didn't do that, then it would be not such a bad thing.
You're describing a process of corporatization that goes along with gentrification. There is a proposal before the Portland City Council that would require all businesses that operate after 10 p.m. to acquire a so-called late night activity permit. It would require businesses to have plans for security, crowd management, identifying high-risk individuals, and appropriately vetting promoters in order to promote the safety of the venue, according to the concept proposal. What do you think about that idea?
That's a very bad idea. I think behind that is an agenda, and that agenda is, you know, the development plan that we've been speaking on. Teresa Marchetti in particular, though, she has a storied history of intimidating bars and telling them what to do and not to do, and she's been on record saying that's not her, you know, her job to tell them what music to play and all that.
You know, so these late night activity permits are, you know, at least would be directed towards all businesses open beyond 10 p.m., and that includes...
But who is that going to affect? I mean, they can cite all these statistics, you know, they could play to people's emotions about safety and security and all this, you know, that's what got us into illegal wars. But anyway, who is that really going to affect? That's going to affect bars, that's going to affect concert goers, and that's going to affect, you know, what they've been fighting against. It's hip-hop. I mean, the police always get portrayed as protecting and serving the people, but, I mean... All they're being used in here is to protect and serve property.
What can venues, what can musicians, artists, what can they do to create spaces for themselves to push back on this kind of development?
I mean, well, just continue to build, man. Like, adapt. We can't just sit around and complain about what's going on. Like, it's happening. As far as I'm concerned, this is an idea, right? Like, they're asking for a public opinion on it, right? So we need to give them public input. We need to get people aware and get people in the building when it's time for people to get in the building.
I have been speaking with Glenn Waco, a local hip-hop artist here in Portland. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
The BNSF and Union Pacific Railways want the state of Oregon to sign confidentiality agreements to restrict information about oil training routes and volumes. The announcement comes after a recent exposé by the Oregonian newspaper. It found that no agency would accept responsibility for keeping track of where oil trains were located at any given time. The railroads are under federal orders to disclose the information to emergency responders, but want the state to keep the information from the public. The state of Washington has refused a similar confidentiality request, saying it violates Washington's public records law. The City Council of Vancouver, Washington, voted to oppose a large crude oil train terminal in that city. BNSF moves highly volatile North Dakota crude oil along the Columbia River in Washington and northwest Oregon, and Union Pacific transports Utah oil through the Columbia River Gorge. Oregon's Emergency Response Commission said today that they've asked Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum to make the decision on confidentiality agreements. A third railroad, Portland and Western, also moves millions of gallons of North Dakota crude to a terminal in Clatskanie, but has not yet asked the state for a confidentiality agreement.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy, with a high of 79. Sunday, we'll see mostly sunny skies, with a high of 80. Today in history, the Great Seattle Fire of 1889 destroyed most of downtown Seattle. Also on this date, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Securities Act of 1933 into law, establishing the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Finally, on June 6, 1982, Israel invaded southern Lebanon, beginning its first war with Lebanon. The quote of the day comes from historian Isaiah Berlin, who said, quote, "Injustice, poverty, slavery, ignorance, these may be cured by reform or revolution. But people do not live only by fighting evils. They live by positive goals, individual and collective, at times incompatible and seldom predictable."
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The dictionary defines a caterpillar as a, quote, worm-like larva and a crawler. Also, that pillar part of the word is derived from a French verb that means to pillage, abuse, mistreat. Now, meet Caterpillar Inc., the world's largest maker of construction and mining machines. A recent report by the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations found that this worm-like behemoth has crawled through a tax loophole to abuse our public trust. Caterpillar has quietly shifted some $8 billion in profits gained from selling parts on the global market into a Swiss subsidiary in order to avoid paying more than $2 billion in taxes owed to our country. Even though this subsidiary has only 65 employees and neither makes nor sells spare parts, Caterpillar made a slick accounting maneuver that channeled 85% of its international parts profits into what amounts to a tax shelter. Corporate officials tried to bluster their way through a subcommittee hearing, insisting that their offshoring of profits was merely meant to streamline the corporate flowchart. It was prudent, said Caterpillar's top financial officer, to eliminate the unnecessary middleman between the profits made on global sales and the paying of taxes on those profits. That's absolutely absurd, says Senator Carl Levin, the subcommittee chairman. He pointed out that the middleman she was referring to is Caterpillar itself. It designed, made, and sold the products. And the only reason it wormed its profits into a Swiss subsidiary was to cheat on the tax bill it legitimately owes in its home country. This is Jim Hightower saying, when you hear right-wingers say that America doesn't have the money for infrastructure repairs, poverty programs, etc., remember that U.S. corporate giants like Caterpillar have hidden some $2 trillion of their profits in slimy offshore wormholes.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
In the latest in marriage equality news, Wisconsin has become the latest state in which a judge has ruled to allow same-sex marriages, overturning the state's ban on same-sex marriage as unconstitutional. This is similar to the ruling in Oregon 2 weeks ago that allowed same-sex marriage licenses to start being issued here. An appeal of the Oregon ruling by a national group opposed to marriage equality was denied earlier this week, and same-sex marriage will be allowed in Oregon with no chance of being overturned. Meanwhile, North Dakota has become the last state in the union to be hit with a marriage equality lawsuit. All 50 states now have either overturned their bans on same-sex marriage or have cases pending to overturn the bans. Nationally, the Supreme Court has declined to hear cases that could lead to reimposing state-level bans on same-sex marriage. Instead, the court has made clear that same-sex couples must be allowed to marry in accordance with the U.S. Constitution.
Columbia University professor and Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has published a white paper to explain why the current United States tax code must be modified. Stiglitz is the former head of the World Bank, but has become one of that institution's biggest critics. He blames the near shutdown of the U.S. government and the near default on our national debt on politics. Stiglitz points out that the money needed to pull the country out of the financial tailspin sits offshore in tax shelters. American corporations are currently sitting on $2 trillion that are sheltered in offshore tax-exempt havens. Even though unemployment hovers at just below 7% right now, 20 million people are underemployed and workers are earning lower wages than before 2008. Stiglitz points to progressive taxes that won't hurt the economy and inheritance taxes that promote spending. The white paper has seven elements for a tax reform, including raising corporate income tax rates while giving generous tax incentive to firms which operate and employ people in the United States. The full report can be found on the web at RooseveltInstitute.org.
Former Oregon prisoner Kevin Rashid Johnson continues to face a severe medical crisis without intervention from prison staff at a maximum security facility in Texas. The medical crisis began on May 14th with blurred vision and severe headaches. After 3 weeks of symptoms, Rashid still has not seen a doctor. Hypertension has been responsible for the death of other prisoners in Texas who were not given treatment in time. Rashid Johnson has spent decades in solitary confinement. He is known as a black liberationist and political writer and poet. Last week, his supporters put out an urgent medical alert e-blast urging people to call the warden of the prison to push the warden to provide the needed medical care. Rashid Johnson faced a similar crisis last August when he was being held in Eastern Oregon. He was later transferred to Texas and has been held in solitary confinement since his transfer. Yesterday, one of Rashid's supporters was able to speak to both the warden and the health services staff. They are stating that Rashid now has received blood pills and his pressure is being monitored. In a call with his Oregon lawyer, Ben Hale, Rashid said that he hopes his plight will help people see the cruel reality of solitary confinement and isolation of prisoners and their effects on inmates' health. His supporters say that it is a human rights violation to keep prisoners in solitary and deny them access to their legal team and health care.
A group of peace activists has embarked on a two-week march through Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan to bring attention to the issue of drone warfare. Their destination is an airfield in Battle Creek, Michigan, which is set to become the next command center for U.S. drone attacks. Kathy Kelly is one of the nation's leading peace activists and one of the participants in this walk. Just before embarking on the peace march, Kathy was arrested at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri to oppose the use of drone warfare there. She spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg from Indiana today.
And I wonder if you can talk about the purpose of the walk and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, thanks, Jenka. Voices for Creative Nonviolence is concerned about the conversion of yet another Air National Guard base in the United States to a base wherein pilots will be trained to operate weaponized drones over other countries such as Afghanistan and Yemen, Pakistan, Mali, and Somalia. So we're doing what we've done before. Last year we walked across Iowa from the Rock Island Arsenal to the Des Moines Air National Guard base, which was being renamed the Air Attack Wing, and will be using weaponized drones. And now we're going to Battle Creek, Michigan, to help all people along the way on a route that takes us from Chicago, where we started at the Boeing headquarters. Boeing manufactures and designs drones, through some pretty blighted areas where people's needs for housing, for education, even for food aren't being met. And people have told us along the way, although we've had such a warm reception, and even areas where people's homes are being demolished while big corporations like BP, British Petroleum, are getting their very land condemned, and Enbridge, for the sake of fracking, getting land condemned. So we've certainly learned a lot just in these few days.
You said that BP is actually forcing people out of their homes?
Yeah, I really encourage people to take a look at a website about a place called Marktown. It was a planned village, a beautifully designed village. You walk into it and you think, am I in Europe someplace? And people were proud of their work, and they thought the corporations will never really betray us. So they've changed their minds. British Petroleum is definitely betraying people in this village, and only one owner has more or less sold out, but that owner is an absentee landlord who owns about 22 homes. So even as we were walking through this beautifully laid out village with a tremendous history. One home was that very day demolished and watched as workers were kind of finishing it off. And, you know, Jenka, I had just come from Jeju Island in South Korea late last month, and I was kind of astonished to realize that the same things that people in this island that is struggling mightily against the militarization of their island, the same things I heard those people say were being said by people in this working class area one state away from me. So the tentacles of the corporations extend, and they're certainly in service of and protected by huge military complexes, as we've learned to say. And then today we walk past the gigantic prison, the Indiana State Prison, and that's yet another sign of the terrible failure, the inability of the United States to meet the most basic human needs of its own citizens.
And what would you say to those who claim that drones are safer for U.S. soldiers than actually going and engaging in combat?
Well, hearing that 22 United States combat veterans kill themselves every day, I surely don't want any soldiers in combat. I don't want young people to enlist. I think they are placing themselves in a very, very, very dangerous situation where the United States may demand that they loan themselves to possibly kill and possibly be killed and be maimed or emotionally destroyed for life. But when we find out about the drone operators and their rates of trauma, we're finding out that the people operating these drones are asking for assistance because they feel subjected to the same stresses that people experience in a war zone, that they're 18 inches away from the war, even though they're